The Last Day of Peace. Having got the Germans and Poles to agree to direct negotiations, as they thought, the British and French governments, though highly skeptical of Hitler, had concentrated their efforts on trying to bring such talks about. In this, Britain took the lead, supported diplomatically in Berlin and especially in Warsaw by France. Although the British did not advise the Poles to accept Hitler's ultimatum and fetch an emissary with full powers to Berlin on August 30th, holding that such a demand was, as Halifax had wired Henderson, wholly unreasonable, they did urge Colonel Beck to declare that he was prepared to negotiate with Berlin without delay. This was the substance of a message which Halifax got off to his ambassador in Warsaw late on the night of August 30th. Kennard was to inform Beck of the contents of the British note to Germany, which Henderson was presenting to Ribbentrop, assure him that Britain would stand by its commitments to Poland, but stress the importance of Poland's agreeing to direct discussions with Germany at once. "We regard it as most important," Halifax telegraphed, "from the point of view of the internal situation in Germany and of world opinion, that so long as the German government profess themselves ready to negotiate, no opportunity should be given them for placing the blame for a conflict on Poland." Kennard saw Beck at midnight, and the Polish foreign minister promised to consult his government and give him a considered reply by midday on August 31st. Kennard's dispatch describing this interview reached the British Foreign Office at 8 a.m., and Halifax was not entirely satisfied with it. At noon, it was now the last day of August, he wired Kennard that he should concert with his French colleague in Warsaw, Léon Noël, the French ambassador, and suggest to the Polish government that they should now make known to the German government, preferably direct, but if not through us, that they have been made aware of our last reply to German government, and that they confirm their acceptance of the principle of direct discussions. French government fear that German government might take advantage of silence on part of Polish government. Lord Halifax was still uneasy about his Polish allies, and less than 2 hours later at 1:45 p.m., he again wired Kennard, "Please at once inform Polish government and advise them, in view of fact that they have accepted principle of direct discussions, immediately to instruct Polish ambassador in Berlin to say to German government that, if latter have any proposals, he is ready to transmit them to his government so that they may at once consider them and make suggestions for early discussions." But shortly before this telegram was dispatched, Beck, in response to the démarche of the midnight before, had already informed the British ambassador in a written note that the Polish government confirmed their readiness for a direct exchange of views with the German government, and had orally assured him that he was instructing Lipsky to seek an interview with Ribbentrop to say that Poland had accepted the British proposals. When Kennard asked Beck what Lipsky would do if Ribbentrop handed over the German proposals, the foreign minister replied that his ambassador in Berlin would not be authorized to accept them, as, in view of past experience, it might be accompanied by some sort of an ultimatum. The important thing, said Beck, was to re-establish contact, and then details should be discussed as to where, with whom, and on what basis negotiations should be commenced. In the light of the past experience which the once pro-Nazi Polish foreign minister mentioned, this was not an unreasonable view. Beck added, Kennard wired London, that if invited to go to Berlin, he would of course not go, as he had no intention of being treated like President Hacha. Actually, Beck did not send to Lipsky quite those instructions. Instead of saying that Poland accepted the British proposals, Lipsky was told to tell the Germans that Poland was favorably considering the British suggestions and would make a formal reply during the next few hours at the latest. There was more to Beck's instructions to Lipsky than that, and the Germans, having solved the Polish ciphers, knew it. For a simple and good reason that will soon become apparent, the Germans were not anxious to receive the Polish ambassador in Berlin. It was too late. At 1 p.m., a few minutes after he had received his telegraphic instructions from Warsaw, Lipsky requested an interview with Ribbentrop for the purpose of presenting a communication from his government. After cooling his heels for a couple of hours, he received a telephone call from Weizsäcker asking, on behalf of the German foreign minister, whether he was coming as an emissary with full power or in some other capacity. "I replied," Lipsky reported later in his final report, "that I was asking for an interview as ambassador to present a declaration from my government." Another long wait followed. At 5 p.m., Atolico called on Ribbentrop and communicated the urgent desire of the Duce that the Führer should receive Lipsky to establish in this way at least the minimum contact necessary for the avoidance of a final breach. The German foreign minister promised to transmit the Duce's wishes to the Führer. This was not the first call the Italian ambassador had made in the Wilhelmstrasse on this last day of August in order to try to save the peace. At 9 that morning, Attolico had advised Rome that the situation was desperate, and that unless something new comes up, there will be war in a few hours. In Rome, Mussolini and Ciano put their heads together to find something new. The first result was that Ciano telephoned Halifax to say that Mussolini could not intervene unless he were able to produce for Hitler a fat prize, Danzig. The British Foreign Secretary did not rise to the bait. He told Ciano the first thing to be done was to establish direct contact between the Germans and the Poles, through Lipsky. Thus, at 11:30 a.m., Attolico saw Weizsäcker at the German Foreign Office and apprised him that Mussolini was in contact with London, and had suggested the return of Danzig as a first step toward a German-Polish settlement, and that the Duce needed a certain margin of time to perfect his plan for peace. In the meantime, couldn't the German government receive Lipsky? Lipsky was received by Ribbentrop at 6:15 p.m., more than 5 hours after he had requested the interview. It did not last long. The ambassador, despite his fatigue and his worn nerves, behaved with dignity. He read to the Nazi foreign minister a written communication. Last night the Polish government were informed by the British government of an exchange of views with the Reich government as to a possibility of direct negotiations between the Polish and German governments. The Polish government are favorably considering the British government's suggestion and will make them a formal reply on the subject during the next few hours. I added, said Lipsky later, that I had been trying to present this declaration since 1 p.m. When Ribbentrop asked him whether he had come as an emissary empowered to negotiate, the ambassador replied that, for the time being, he had only been instructed to remit the communication which he had just read, whereupon he handed it to the foreign minister. He had expected, Ribbentrop said, that Lipsky would come as a fully empowered delegate, and when the ambassador again declared that he had no such role, he was dismissed. Ribbentrop said he would inform the Führer. On my return to the embassy, Lipsky later related, I found myself unable to communicate with Warsaw as the Germans had cut my telephone. The questions of Weizsäcker and Ribbentrop as to the ambassador's status as a negotiator were purely formal, with an eye, no doubt, for the record, for ever since noon, when Lipsky's communication had been received by telegram from Warsaw, the Germans had known that he was not coming, as they had demanded, as a plenipotentiary. They had decoded the telegram immediately. A copy had been sent to Goering, who showed it to Dolores and instructed him to take it post-haste to Henderson, so that the British government, as the field marshal later explained on the stand at Nuremberg, should find out as quickly as possible how intransigent the Polish attitude was. Goering read to the tribunal the secret instructions to Lipsky, which were that the ambassador should refrain from conducting official negotiations under any circumstances, and should insist that he had no plenipotentiary powers, and that he was merely empowered to deliver the official communication of his government. In his testimony, the field marshal made much of this during his vain effort to convince the Nuremberg judges that Poland had sabotaged Hitler's last bid for peace, and that, as he said, he, Goering, did not want war and had done everything he could to prevent it. But Goering's veracity was only a shade above Ribbentrop's, and one example of this was his further assertion to the court that only after Lipsky's visit to the Wilhelmstrasse at 6:15 p.m. on August 31st did Hitler decide on invasion the next day. The truth was quite otherwise. In fact, all these scrambling 11th-hour moves of the weary and exhausted diplomats, and of the overwrought men who directed them on the afternoon and evening of that last day of August 1939, were but a flailing of the air, completely futile, and in the case of the Germans, entirely and purposely deceptive. For at half-afternoon on August 31st, before Lord Halifax had urged the Poles to be more accommodating, and before Lipsky had called on Ribbentrop, and before the Germans had made publicly known their generous proposals to Poland, and before Mussolini had tried to intervene, Adolf Hitler had taken his final decision and issued the decisive order that was to throw the planet into its bloodiest war. Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, Most Secret, Berlin, August 31st, 1939. Directive number 1 for the conduct of the war. 1. Now that all the political possibilities of disposing by peaceful means of a situation on the eastern frontier, which is intolerable for Germany, are exhausted, I have determined on a solution by force. 2. The attack on Poland is to be carried out in accordance with the preparations made for Case White, with the alterations which result, where the army is concerned, from the fact that it has in the meantime almost completed its dispositions. Allotment of tasks and the operational target remain unchanged. Date of attack, September 1, 1939. Time of attack, 4:45 a.m. Inserted in red pencil. This timing also applies to the operation at Gdynia, Bay of Danzig, and the Dirschau Bridge. 3. In the West, it is important that the responsibility for the opening of hostilities should rest squarely on England and France. For the time being, insignificant frontier violations should be met by purely local action. The neutrality of Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and Switzerland, to which we have given assurances, must be scrupulously observed. On land, the German western frontier is not to be crossed without my express permission. At sea, the same applies for all warlike actions or actions which could be regarded as such. A marginal note in the directive clears up this ambiguous point. Thus, Atlantic forces will, for the time being, remain in a waiting position. 4. If Britain and France open hostilities against Germany, it is the task of the Wehrmacht formations operating in the West to conserve their forces as much as possible, and thus maintain the conditions for a victorious conclusion of the operations against Poland. Within these limits, enemy forces and their military economic resources are to be damaged as much as possible. Orders to go over to the attack I reserve, in any case, to myself. The army will hold the West Wall and make preparations to prevent its being outflanked in the north through violation of Belgian or Dutch territory by the Western powers. The Navy will carry on warfare against merchant shipping, directed mainly at England. The Air Force is, in the first place, to prevent the French and British Air Forces from attacking the German Army and the German Lebensraum. In conducting the war against England, preparations are to be made for the use of the Luftwaffe in disrupting British supplies by sea, the armaments industry, and the transport of troops to France. A favorable opportunity is to be taken for an effective attack on massed British naval units, especially against battleships and aircraft carriers. Attacks against London are reserved for my decision. Preparations are to be made for attacks against the British mainland, bearing in mind that partial success with insufficient forces is in all circumstances to be avoided. Adolf Hitler. Shortly after noon on August 31st, then, Hitler formally and in writing directed the attack on Poland to begin at dawn the next day. As his first war directive indicates, he was still not quite sure what Britain and France would do. He would refrain from attacking them first. If they took hostile action, he was prepared to meet it. Perhaps, as Halder had indicated in his diary entry of August 28th, the British would go through the motions of honoring their obligation to Poland and wage a sham war. If so, the Führer would not take it amiss. Probably, the Nazi dictator made his fateful decision a little earlier than 12:30 p.m. on the last day of August. At 6:40 p.m. on the previous day, Halder jotted in his diary a communication from Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Sievert, adjutant of General von Brauchitsch. Make all preparations so that attack can begin at 4:30 a.m. on September 1st. Should negotiations in London require postponement, then September 2nd. In that case, we shall be notified before 3 p.m. tomorrow. Führer, either September 1st or 2nd. All off after September 2nd. Because of the autumn rains, the attack had to begin at once or be called off altogether. Very early on the morning of August 31st, while Hitler still claimed he was waiting for the Polish emissary, the German army received its orders. At 6:30 a.m., Halder jotted down, "Word from the Reich Chancellery that jump-off order has been given for September 1st. At 11:30, General Stulpnagel reports on fixing of time of attack for 04:45, 4:45 a.m. Intervention of West said to be unavoidable. In spite of this, Führer has decided to attack. An hour later, the formal Directive No. 1 was issued. There was, I remember, an eerie atmosphere that day in Berlin. Everyone seemed to be going around in a daze. At 7:25 in the morning, Weizsäcker had telephoned Ulrich von Hassel, one of the conspirators, and asked him to hurry over to see him. The state secretary saw only one last hope, that Henderson should persuade Lipsky and his government to send a Polish plenipotentiary at once, or at least to announce the intention of dispatching one. Could the unemployed Hassel see his friend Henderson at once, and also Göring to this end? Hassel tried. He saw Henderson twice and Göring once. But veteran diplomat and now anti-Nazi that he was, he did not seem to realize that events had outstripped such puny efforts. Nor did he grasp the extent of his own confusions and of those of Weizsäcker and all the good Germans who, of course, wanted peace, on German terms. For it must have been obvious to them on August 31st that there would be war, unless either Hitler or the Poles backed down, and that there was not the slightest possibility of the one or the other capitulating. And yet, as Hassel's diary entry for this day makes clear, he expected the Poles to back down and to follow the same disastrous route which the Austrians and Czechs had taken. When Henderson tried to point out to Hassel that the chief difficulty was in German methods, in the way they were trying to order the Poles around like stupid little boys, Hassel retorted that the persistent silence of the Poles was also objectionable. He added that everything depended on Lipsky putting in an appearance, not to ask questions, but to declare his willingness to negotiate. Even to Hassel, the Poles, who were threatened with imminent attack on trumped-up Nazi charges, were not supposed to ask questions. And when the former ambassador summed up his final conclusions about the outbreak of the war, though he blamed Hitler and Ribbentrop for knowingly taking the risk of war with the Western powers, he also heaped much responsibility on the Poles and even on the British and French. The Poles, for their part, he wrote, with Polish conceit and Slavic aimlessness, confident of English and French support, had missed every remaining chance of avoiding war. One can only ask what chance they missed except to surrender to Hitler's full demands. The government in London, Hassel added, gave up the race in the very last days and adopted a kind of devil-may-care attitude. France went through the same stages, only with much more hesitation. Mussolini did all in his power to avoid war. If an educated, cultivated, and experienced diplomat such as Hassel could be so woolly in his thinking, is it any wonder that it was easy for Hitler to take in the mass of the German people? There now followed, during the waning afternoon of the last day of peace, a somewhat grotesque interlude. In view of what is now known about the decisions of the day, it might have been thought that the commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, which was to carry out far-flung air operations against Poland beginning at dawn on the morrow, would be a very busy field marshal. On the contrary, Dollarus took him out to lunch at the Hotel Esplanade and plied him with good food and drink. The cognac was of such high quality that Göring insisted on lugging away two bottles of it when he left. Having got the field marshal into the proper humor, Dollarus proposed that he invite Henderson for a talk. After receiving Hitler's permission, he did so, inviting him and Forbes to his house for tea at 5 p.m. Dollarus, whose presence is not mentioned by Henderson in his final report or in his book, says that he suggested that Göring, on behalf of Germany, meet a Polish emissary in Holland, and that Henderson promised to submit the proposal to London. The British ambassador's version of the tea talk, given in his final report, was that Göring talked for 2 hours of the iniquities of the Poles and about Herr Hitler's and his own desire for friendship with England. It was a conversation which led to nowhere. My general impression was that it constituted a final but forlorn effort on his part to detach Britain from the Poles. I augured the worst from the fact that he was in a position at such a moment to give me so much of his time. He could scarcely have afforded at such a moment to spare time in conversation if it did not mean that everything down to the last detail was now ready for action. The third and most piquant description of this bizarre tea party was given by Forbes in answer to a questionnaire from Göring's lawyer at Nuremberg. The atmosphere was negative and desperate, though friendly. Göring's statement to the British ambassador was, if the Poles should not give in, Germany would crush them like lice, and if Britain should decide to declare war, he would regret it greatly, but it would be most imprudent of Britain. Later in the evening, Henderson, according to his own account, drafted a dispatch to London saying that it would be quite useless for me to make any further suggestions, since they would now only be outstripped by events. and that the only course remaining to us was to show our inflexible determination to resist force by force. He may have drafted it that evening, but he did not send it to London until 3:45 p.m. the next day, nearly 12 hours after the German attack on Poland had begun. It followed several of his telegrams, which, like it, were telephoned to London, so that transmission was simultaneous, reporting the outbreak of hostilities. It read, "Mutual distrust of Germans and Poles is so complete that I do not feel I can usefully acquiesce in any further suggestions from here, which would only once again be outstripped by events or lead to nothing as the result of methods followed or of considerations of honor and prestige. Last hope lies in inflexible determination on our part to resist force by force." Sir Neville Henderson's disillusionment seemed complete. Despite all his strenuous efforts over the years to appease the insatiable Nazi dictator, his mission to Germany, as he called it, had failed. In the fading hours of August's last day, this shallow, debonair Englishman, whose personal diplomacy in Berlin had been so disastrously blind, tried to face up to the shattering collapse of his vain hopes and abortive plans. And though he would suffer one more typical, incredible lapse the next day, the first day of war, an ancient truth was dawning on him, that there were times and circumstances when, as he at last said, force must be met by force. Since friends who have read this section have expressed doubts about this writer's objectivity in dealing with Henderson, perhaps another's view of the British ambassador in Berlin should be given. Sir L. B. Namier, a British historian, has summed up Henderson as follows. "Conceited, vain, self-opinionated, rigidly adhering to his preconceived ideas, he poured out telegrams, dispatches, and letters in unbelievable numbers and of formidable length, repeating 100 times the same ill-founded views and ideas. Obtuse enough to be a menace and not stupid enough to be innocuous, he proved un homme néfaste." Namier, In the Nazi Era, page 162. As darkness settled over Europe on the evening of August 31, 1939, and 1.5 million German troops began moving forward to their final positions on the Polish border for the jump off at dawn, all that remained for Hitler to do was to perpetrate some propaganda trickery to prepare the German people for the shock of aggressive war. The people were in need of the treatment which Hitler, abetted by Goebbels and Himmler, had become so expert in applying. I had been about in the streets of Berlin, talking with the ordinary people, and that morning noted in my diary, "Everybody against the war, people talking openly. How can a country go into a major war with a population so dead against it?" Despite all my experience in the Third Reich, I asked such a naive question. Hitler knew the answer very well. Had he not the week before on his Bavarian mountaintop promised the generals that he would give a propagandist reason for starting the war, and admonished them not to mind whether it was plausible or not? "The victor," he had told them, "will not be asked afterward whether he told the truth or not. In starting and waging a war, it is not right that matters, but victory." At 9 p.m., as we have seen, all German radio stations broadcast the Führer's Polish peace proposals, which, as they were read over the air, seemed so reasonable to this misled correspondent. The fact that Hitler had never presented them to the Poles, nor even, except in a vague and unofficial manner, to the British, and then, less than 24 hours before, was brushed over. In fact, in a lengthy statement explaining to the German people how their government had exhausted every diplomatic means to preserve the peace, the Chancellor, no doubt aided by Goebbels, showed that he had lost none of his touch for masterly deceit. After the British government on August 28th, it said, had offered its mediation between Germany and Poland, the German government on the next day had replied that, in spite of being skeptical of the desire of the Polish government to come to an understanding, they declared themselves ready in the interests of peace to accept the British mediation or suggestion. They considered it necessary, if the danger of a catastrophe was to be avoided, that action must be taken readily and without delay. They declared themselves ready to receive a personage appointed by the Polish government up to the evening of August 30th, with the proviso that the latter was empowered not only to discuss, but to conduct and conclude negotiations. Instead of a statement regarding the arrival of an authorized personage, the first answer the government of the Reich received to their readiness for an understanding was the news of the Polish mobilization. The Reich government cannot be expected continually not only to emphasize their willingness to start negotiations, but actually to be ready to do so, while being from the Polish side merely put off with empty subterfuges and meaningless declarations. It has once more been made clear, as a result of a démarche which has meanwhile been made by the Polish ambassador, that the latter himself has no plenary powers either to enter into any discussion or even to negotiate. The Führer and the German government have thus waited 2 days in vain for the arrival of a Polish negotiator. In these circumstances, the German government regard their proposals as having this time too been rejected, although they considered that these proposals, in the form in which they were made known to the British government also, were more than loyal, fair, and practicable. Good propaganda, to be effective, as Hitler and Goebbels had learned from experience, needs more than words. It needs deeds, however much they may have to be fabricated. Having convinced the German people, and of this the writer can testify from personal observation, that the Poles had rejected the Führer's generous peace offer, there remained only the concocting of a deed which would prove that not Germany but Poland had attacked first. For this last shady business, it will be remembered, the Germans, at Hitler's direction, had made careful preparation. For 6 days, Alfred Naujoks, the intellectual SS ruffian, had been waiting at Gliwice on the Polish border to carry out a simulated Polish attack on the German radio station there. The plan had been revised. SS men outfitted in Polish army uniforms were to do the shooting, and drugged concentration camp inmates were to be left dying as casualties. This last delectable part of the operation had, as we have seen, the expressive codename Canned Goods. There were to be several such faked Polish attacks, but the principal one was to be on the radio station at Gliwice. At noon on August 31st, Naujoks related in his Nuremberg affidavit, I received from Heydrich the code word for the attack which was to take place at 8 o'clock that evening. Heydrich said, in order to carry out this attack, report to Müller for canned goods. I did this and gave Müller instructions to deliver the man near the radio station. I received this man and had him laid down at the entrance to the station. He was alive but completely unconscious. I tried to open his eyes. I could not recognize by his eyes that he was alive, only by his breathing. I did not see the gun wounds, but a lot of blood was smeared across his face. He was in civilian clothes. We seized the radio station as ordered, broadcast a speech of 3 to 4 minutes over an emergency transmitter, fired some pistol shots, and left. The speech in Polish had been outlined by Heydrich to Naujoks. It contained inflammatory statements against Germany and declared that the Poles were attacking. The Polish attack at Gliwice was used by Hitler in his speech to the Reichstag the next day, and was cited as justification for the Nazi aggression by Ribbentrop, Weizsäcker, and other members of the Foreign Office in their propaganda. The New York Times and other newspapers reported it, as well as similar incidents, in their issues of September 1, 1939. It remains only to be added that according to the testimony at Nuremberg of General Lauhausen, of the Abwehr, all the SS men who wore Polish uniforms in the simulated attacks that evening were, as the general put it, put out of the way. Berlin, that evening, was largely shut off from the outside world, except for outgoing press dispatches and broadcasts which reported the Führer's offer to Poland and the German allegations of Polish attacks on German territory. I tried to get through on the telephone to Warsaw, London, and Paris, but was told that communications with these capitals were cut. Berlin itself was quite normal in appearance. There had been no evacuation of women and children, as there had been in Paris and London, nor any sandbagging of storefront windows, as was reported from the other capitals. Toward 4 a.m. on September 1st, after my last broadcast, I drove back from Broadcasting House to the Adlon Hotel. There was no traffic. The houses were dark. The people were asleep, and perhaps, for all I knew, had gone to bed hoping for the best, for peace. Hitler himself had been in fine fettle all day. At 6 p.m. on August 31st, General Halder noted in his diary, "Führer calm, has slept well. Decision against evacuation in the West shows that he expects France and England will not take action." During the day, Hitler found time to send a telegram to the Duke of Windsor at Antibes, France. Berlin, August 31, 1939. I thank you for your telegram of August 27th. You may rest assured that my attitude toward Britain and my desire to avoid another war between our peoples remain unchanged. It depends on Britain, however, whether my wishes for the future development of German-British relations can be realized. Adolf Hitler. This is the first mention of the former King of England, but by no means the last, in the captured German documents. Subsequently, for a time, as will be recorded further on, the Duke of Windsor loomed large in certain calculations of Hitler and Ribbentrop. Admiral Canaris, chief of the Abwehr in OKW and one of the key anti-Nazi conspirators, was in a different mood. Though Hitler was carrying Germany into war, an action which the Canaris circle had supposedly sworn to prevent by getting rid of the dictator, there was no conspiracy in being now that the moment for it had arrived. Later in the afternoon, Gisevius had been summoned to OKW headquarters by Colonel Oster. This nerve center of Germany's military might was humming with activity. Canaris drew Gisevius down a dimly lit corridor. In a voice choked with emotion, he said, "This means the end of Germany."